We just heard several recordings from the Motown record label. That was Marvin Gaye. I heard it through the grapevine. Before that, we heard the Four Tops, Reach Out, I'll Be There. We skipped the Four Tops, and we heard the Supremes, You Can't Hurry Love, the Four Tops, I Can't Help Myself, and the Temptations, My Girl. And it's 4 minutes to 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. And with me is music writer Nelson George, who has just written a history of Motown Records. It's titled Where Did Our Love Go? Motown Records, which was created by Berry Gordy in 1959, created a soul sound that crossed over to black and white audiences. Motown was the first black-owned record company to score so many hits, and it became one of the most successful black-owned businesses in America. Motown had a stable of writers, producers, singers, and session musicians, and that consistency was responsible for what became known as the Motown sound. It was epitomized by records like the ones we just heard, and by artists like Smokey Robinson, Marvin Gaye, The Supremes, Martha and the Vandellas, The Temptations. Motown frequently signed singers when they were very young, and some were still kids, like Stevie Wonder and Michael Jackson. In some ways, this made Motown like a family, but it also made for some very bitter separations when performers wanted their independence. Detroit was the home of Motown Records during its first 10 years of existence. The name Motown comes from the contraction of Motortown, which the city was called when the automobile business was booming. Nelson George argues that when Motown Records moved from Detroit to Los Angeles, the heart of show business, it lost its sound and it became just another record company. Nelson George's new book, Where Did Our Love Go?, is published by the St. Martin's Press. He's the black music editor of Billboard magazine and also the author of the best-selling book, The Michael Jackson Story. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, very good to be here this afternoon.
Let me ask you why you wrote the book. Is it because of the importance of Motown music to you personally?
Well, partially. I mean, I grew up, the first record that I remember really liking was Please, Mr. Postman, and my mother bought me a copy of it because I kept playing hers. It goes back to when I was a kid. Obviously, my fascination was the music. But also, as I got older, I began to realize that this, in a country which doesn't have that many major multi-million-dollar black-owned businesses, that Motown was very much an anomaly. And that also, it was a great story. There were all these characters, these different artists, these different personalities. And yet, the books that I would read, the articles I would read, never quite satisfied me. I never felt I had a grasp on what really was going on. Because I realized pretty early that people didn't just do things by themselves. It has to be a structure that makes an organization work. And I got into record business sort of as a writer working at Billboard. I guess I just sort of figured, well, isn't there more to the story than I think? I mean, I loved music, and I always would see who Booker T and the MGs were. I knew who played on Bob Dylan's records. I knew who played and all the New York session musicians. But I didn't know who these guys were at Motown. So one day, I guess in the early 80s, I decided I'm going to try and find this out. I got Musician Magazine, a pretty good music magazine out of New York, to give me an assignment, you know, see if I can find anything out. There was very, very, very little actually written. No interviews I could find with the musicians. Maybe one. I found one interview with one musician. Never anything with the drummers, never anything with the bass players. And through my contacts in the music business, I began to run people down. One guy in particular was a man named Earl Van Dyke, who was the Motown band leader. And Earl was a treasure trove of information for me. He knew where everyone was. His own perspective, being the band leader, was quite different from what I'd heard about Motown.
And, of course, from the session musicians, you'd get a really different perspective than you would from talking to someone like Diana Ross, or to the really big stars who everybody knows.
But to me, it was like looking at a pyramid. I mean, if we look at Berry Gordy at the top and Diana and Marvin and those people along the way, the base of the pyramid is the music. And these are the guys who provided it. And from meeting with them, I also met people who were involved in the next other levels, like the people in artist development, the choreographers, the talent management people, the people who are in the A&R department, the people in publishing. I'd already interviewed Diana Ross, you know, as part of my general journalistic duties. I'd interviewed Marvin Gaye. I'd interviewed a Smokey. I'd interviewed Stevie. So I had their perspective, and their perspective is pretty well detailed in the millions of interviews they've done. But what the book tries to do is to weave in what we know or what we think we know along with these other perspectives, these other voices. And I really let my vision be guided by what I got from the people who are not the main stars.
Now, the person who actually founded the company, Berry Gordy, wouldn't give you an interview. I guess he doesn't give interviews to anybody.
Not very many. He did a few at the time of the Motown special to hype the show. And what happened actually is that a friend of mine in Detroit, who was with the Detroit Free Press, gave me his basic interview with Berry, and because so little of it had actually been used. And what happened, I must say that my fellow journalists were quite accommodating, because everyone is, it's so funny, so many music writers I talked to had this vision, they wanted to do a Motown, everyone had wanted to do a Motown book. It was like, yeah, man, Motown really needs to be written about. But no one had really taken the time, and people were sort of intimidated. This was such a big company, had a real serious mystique, and no one had really penetrated it before, so, and it's much easier to do a magazine article for someone than to try and undertake a book. And I just decided I was going to try and do it. And so people helped me along the way, gave me information.
My guest is music writer Nelson George, and his new book is Where Did Our Love Go? The Rise and Fall of the Motown Sound. Well, let's talk a little bit about Berry Gordy before we talk about the company he created and the musicians and writers and performers who made music there. He really, musically, was interested first in jazz.
Yeah, he was a big jazz fan. Detroit has always been a big jazz city, in a way like Philadelphia. It had a lot of little clubs. It had a lot of little after-hour spots. And as a young man, he would hang out at these spaces. I think Billie Holiday, who he later made a film about, was one of the people he saw when he was a kid. Miles Davis, Thelonious Monk. He considers these people to this day, you know, some the great musicians. But he just found, he tried to open up a jazz store called the 3D Music Stop, a shop, I believe. And it just didn't happen. He wasn't making money doing that.
So he gave up on jazz because it wasn't profitable.
Yeah.
Then he went into songwriting and producing and worked with Jackie Wilson. What were some of the obstacles he was up against trying to make a living as a songwriter and producer?
Well, in that era, and we're talking about the 50s, the only way you really made money in popular music was really sort of as a, unless you were a songwriter for the major white companies, you could get publishing money, or as a record executive at one of the companies. At that time, ASCAP did not even take R&B songwriters. Didn't take country songwriters either. Basically, ASCAP was basically the home of your Broadway Tin Pan Alley School of Writer. So, you know, that kind of music was considered outlaw music. And though it could make money, it wasn't considered usually profitable because they felt that respectable folks would rather listen to Johnny Mathis or Perry Como than listen to some guy shouting, as they would call it, or making that tribal music, as some people labeled it. So he made some money, but not a whole lot. And he, it really is Smokey Robinson's instigation, who was a young songwriter he'd met in Detroit. They said, well, look, first let's try and make records ourselves and send them out, what they called lease agreements. And some Miracles records, Smokey Robinson, in the name of Ron and Bill, with another one of the Miracles, had records distributed by Chess Records. Chess was be well known for all the blues people that recorded, and for Chuck Berry, Bo Diddley came out of Chess. But this, again, was not as lucrative as he would like it to be. They felt they were putting a lot of money and talent, and other people were benefiting. So they decided, let's try our own company. And so Motown was born, and the sister labels, Tamla and Gordy and the other ones. So I guess it was more or less a creature of necessity. As his sister says, Esther, in one interview, she says, Berry never wanted to be a big businessman like this. He wanted to be a songwriter who could get his songs out there. But necessity made him into a record industry executive.
One of the things that you described that was happening to him is that the record companies he was leasing records to would try to steal his acts from him.
And that's a great story. And unfortunately, I can't give out the name of the company, but there was a definite story where one of the artists had made a lease agreement. He had sent a record out to one of the companies. And it's basically the company was a very established label and said, look, we like these guys. We're going to keep them. You can't stop us from recording them and taking them away from you. And Berry got the support of the black radio stations around the country. In fact, that's one of the key elements to the Motown story, at least in the beginning, is that you look at the world of R&B at that time. There was Atlantic Records, which was controlled by the Erdogans and basically white businessmen from New York. There was King Label, which was controlled by Sid Nathan, who was out of Cincinnati. There was a lot of little companies that specialized in R&B. Chess in Chicago specialized in black music. Most of them were owned by whites. And they felt a special kinship to this little black guy from Detroit who was trying to make it. And they knew he had talent because of the Jackie Wilson stuff. So they stuck by him. And they really said, look, they really basically came down and threatened the guy, look, if you don't stop messing with Berry, we're going to not play your record for a while. And he really backed off. And throughout his history, people like Georgie Woods, who's an institution in Philadelphia, I was one of his key supporters, in fact, during that period. So he had to support a black radio. And that really, in that case, was the Miracles. And in other instances where he was in trouble with people, that support came through for him.
So at the instigation of Smokey Robinson, I guess, he decided to start his own company and, mm-hmm. and get out of the role of the independent
Songwriter. But not the independent record company. And this is the other level of the story, which is interesting, is that independent record companies, again, we'll go back to this, it's not just black, but it was all independent companies. You went through distributors, or basically sort of wholesalers in each market. These guys, and at one point they're like 28 around the country. And their job was, they were the guys who put the records in the stores for you, and they got your money. And they paid you in under like 30 and 60 day billings. Like, you know, any company, you pay your money out, they get the records for you, and they put them in the stores, they get the money back, and they send you your money, your cut. Now, that can be a very lengthy way to get your money. Sometimes 60 days can become 90 days, and 90 days can become 120 days very quickly if they have no respect for you. And a lot of companies, black and white, have had great difficulty sustaining themselves. One of the stories in the book is about Harvey Fuqua, who was a key man at Motown later. He was in charge of artist development. He was an original leader of the Mungos. He discovered Marvin Gaye. But Harvey also had his own record companies. And he said a number of times in interviews that he just was not a good enough businessman. He would have a hit record. He'd have to press up X amount of records to meet demand. He would get them out there, and he wasn't getting his money back. He was getting it slow. Then he couldn't pay his pressing bill. So he couldn't pay his pressing bill because he couldn't get his money from the sales. It was a vicious cycle. Because Motown was better organized than most independent labels, because they had better people in accounting, and because also Barry was not afraid to bring white people in to help him run his company who had experience in the business before, he was able to come through those early days and make it.
It wasn't only his business ability, but it was also the sound that Motown was producing that was responsible for the success of the company. Let's talk about the beginnings of the kind of sound that Motown got known for. I guess their first really big hit was the Smokey Robinson recording of Shop Around. You have a great story about how that recording actually got made with the people who finally made it.
Well, what happened is that they'd worked on the song, and originally the song was intended, I think, for either Marv Johnson or Barrett Strong, one of the other singers who worked there. And Barry had said, "Now let's just try it with a different voice." And they cut it. They had a certain kind of drum sound to it, and they were going to put it out as a single. And then Barry thought about it. A couple of days before it was supposed to be released, he called up Smokey Robinson at like 3 o'clock in the morning. He says, "Look, that record's an all right record. We can make this into a hit. I know we can make this into a hit, but we need to go back and recut the entire tune at 3 o'clock in the morning. Are you sure you want to do this?" You know, Smokey was like still groggy, but Barry insisted, and they went back in. They changed the drum sound, for one thing. You can listen to it as one of those rare pop records that actually seem to have brushes on it. It doesn't have like a hard drum sound. It's a different drum sound. They changed the key of the song. He changed the melody line around a little bit. And, you know, it was the first million-selling record that Motown had had, which was, if this Jackie Wilson hits were an indication, that was certainly one that Barry had a very good sense of what the public sought in popular music. And that was one of the key things about him. He had a very instinctive sense of what the audience wanted during the 60s.
Gordy actually called up everybody in the middle of the night and had them assembled to make this.
Absolutely.
Session.
The bass players, the drummers, the arrangers, and the guys in the group, the Miracles.
Okay, let's listen to Smokey Robinson and the Miracles and the first million-selling record for Motown Records, Shop Around.
When I became of age, my mother called me to her side. She said, "Son, you're growing up now. Pretty soon you'll take a bride." And then she said, "Just because you become a young man now, there's still some things that you don't understand now. Before you ask some girl for a hand now, keep your freedom for as long as you can now. My mama told me, you better shop around. Yeah!
Let some of Shop Around with Smokey Robinson and the Miracle. Smokey Robinson actually became, I think, one of the auteurs of Motown Records.
Oh, absolutely. There were three stages, definite stages, in terms of the dominant producer writers at the company. And Smokey was the beginning, where Berry sort of started it, and under Berry's guide, and Smokey, the early Mary Wells songs, the early Temptation songs, not so much as the Supremes, but the Marvelettes. The Marvelettes he did quite a bit with. Plus the Miracles. He came up with a style of writing, and witty, very clever use of imagery, simple yet very evocative images. The Shop Around thing is a good example. I mean, it's the age-old story of a guy trying to pick his girlfriend, but, you know, my mama told me that's a colloquialism that everyone knows that was very popular during that time. But to use it in a pop song and use it right, that's one of the keys to pop music, is to pick things which are popular and recognizable to the ear and yet can be used in the context of a song in a different way and give it a different meaning. I mean, my favorite song is My Girl, you know, I've Got Sunshine on a Cloudy Day, which is a very simple phrase, but it connotes so much. I mean, you said, well, he must really be in love with this girl. I mean, it's raining and storming, and this guy is in love with this young lady. And so many of his songs have this reverse imagery, where he's able to take the simple, and with a twist, and with you know, the right melody, can make a quite memorable line. And of all the songs out of Motown, you remember almost all the words to Smokey's tunes, which is a great tribute to him. And I want to mention also to his collaborators. Smokey was not a solo. He was not the kind of writer who just wrote everything completely by himself, like a Prince tries to, let's say. He often worked with his collaborators. Often the other guys in Miracles helped him write the songs. They gave a bit of melody, a bit of lyric. And also Marv Tarplin, his guitar player, who's best known for his intro to tracks, you know, down, 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 on Tracks in My Tears. So he was a collaborative artist, but he was the one, his cleverness and his insight into songwriting was like the building block of Motown.
My guest is Nelson George, who writes about music, and we're talking about Motown Records, which is also the subject of his new book, Where Did Our Love Go? The Rise and Fall of the Motown Sound. How would you describe the Motown sound? If you were talking to someone who really didn't know Motown music, what would you say about it?
I look at it as a mix of jazz, because the musicians were jazz-based musicians, sort of a youthful energy that came out of the writers, because they were all very young when they started. You know, some of them weren't even 20. And also technical advances. I mean, the sound of especially the prime quality mid-60s records were very advanced in terms of their production techniques. They were one of the first companies to have an 8-track recording board, which gave them a more expanded sound. They had these little speakers they would use to mix things so that they sounded better. Hear the sound for transistor radios to make them a little more appealing on the radio, because transistor, as we know now, was the medium for hearing music back in those days. And also Motown, they were one of the first places. They even had a little pressing machine on the premises where they would take different mixes of the records or different samples of how it should sound and make them actually put them on discs instead of listening to tapes. Because when you have that, you have a certain degeneration in the sound, but that's the degeneration that the public's going to hear. So these were very advanced and very innovative kind of ideas to have.
And you mentioned that they used jazz musicians for the sessions. Why did they use jazz musicians instead of rhythm and blues musicians?
Well, I think this comes out of Berry's love for jazz, and he felt that these guys were the most skilled people he could find. James Jamerson, the bass player, Benny Benjamin, the drummer, Earl Van Dyke, the piano player, Robert White, guitar player, Uriel Jones, another drummer. These guys were part of a flowering of jazz musicians. Paul Chambers, who played with Coltrane, there's a whole slew of them that came out of Detroit during the 50s. And these guys were their buddies. They used to hang out together. They used to go to places and jam after hours. But they needed to make a living. And not everyone could make a living playing bebop, as we well know. So they got into R&B, and they were all from Detroit. A lot of them had toured around the country with different people. And Berry just felt that these guys had the right sensibility. They also had the right chops to come in and play with them. And for most of the 60s, they basically stayed in-house. They very rarely toured, occasionally went to London, to Europe. Very rarely in the U.S. did these guys appear as a unit, because they were so busy. Once the thing started going about 64, these guys were like around the clock. Sessions would happen at 3 o'clock in the morning. It wasn't unusual for sessions to happen at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Didn't Gordy initially tell them that there'd be a subsidiary jazz record label that they could record on too in exchange?
Oh, there was one.
How long did it last?
Not long. A couple of years. I mean, Johnny Griffith, who was a keyboard player who played on a lot of their records, has a record. I mean, he had a motel. He showed it to me when I went to Detroit, you know, on Jazz Workshop. But the problem was, of course, is that that wasn't profitable. And over time, it was let go and it was de-emphasized. And some of the players who came in there as jazz people ended up playing on the records. And before they sort of got sucked into Motown as talents instead of just as performers.
And they also would sometimes bring in classical music players, especially for the violin backings for some of the songs. Did that usually work out okay? Were there a lot of musical conflicts between the session musicians and the symphony musicians who were brought in for a date?
Maybe at first there were some because, you know, the writers at Motown were not all tech, especially beginning, I guess say earlier, they weren't technically adept. They didn't have sheet music laid out like we have today. Very often they just had chord sheets. And for the bass players and the drummers, that was all right. But these guys were used to playing note for note from a score. So there were some moments of like, what is this stuff? It's very amateurish, you know, that kind of attitude toward the Motown music. But once they started making hits and appearing on hit records and making considerable session fees, that attitude turned around a great deal.
What were the ways of shopping for talent that Motown used?
I mean shopping?
Well, getting and signing the performers.
Well, at that time, okay, Detroit, Michigan, in the 50s, and even to some degree today because it's up north from most of the main way of America, it's not on either the coast, there weren't that many entertainment enterprises in Detroit for them to go to. So people came in knocking on the door. Stevie came in because someone who was one of the Miracles recommended him to Barry. Diana Ross, and basically they met Smokey, and he talked to Barry about it, but basically they hung around until they got a gig. Martha Reeves was a secretary, and she came there. She couldn't get a job as a singer. She took a job as a secretary. So it was basically a very no big talent raids here. It was more or less people came in off the street and asked for a gig or asked for opportunity. And at that particular time, Motown was so small that it was quite all right, just like your mom-and-pop record business.
Once you were in Motown, how are you groomed to become part of that group?
Well, they had a number of... They had what they called artist development. And that was they had a building right on West Grand Boulevard. They had one floor which would have a place for you to look. You can look and have your clothes fitted and look at that. They had a place where you could go and take dance lessons. I mean, work on your choreography with Charlie Atkins. They had people who had arrangers who came in and did your vocal arrangements for you to help you. So when you did your live show, they take your music and say, okay, this is a hit record, but we have to rearrange this song so you can sing it live. They had people come in and every now and then talk to you about your elocution so that you talked a certain way and you sat up well. Not everyone was a great student at this, of course. Diana Ross is probably the epitome of all of this. But it was this kind of training to give you a certain kind of Motown look, Motown movement. It stamped you as an artist for them. And it was a very sophisticated movement. People had tried it before, but no one had ever done it quite like Motown. Certainly not on that level and with that consistency.
The Motown performers' lives were really dominated by the company. Do you think it's fair to say that once you became a Motown artist, your life was basically designed by the company?
Well, certainly during this period, I think that's very true. These are young people, and it gave them a sense of purpose to be part of an institute. And when you're younger, you have much more energy. You're much more willing to be molded and malleable because you're out there to learn. You're out there to grow. And the people who learned and grew the best were the ones who succeeded the longest, I think. And the ones that had more problems. Like, Marvin always had a problem. Marvin and the choreographer would have problems because Marvin wouldn't always want to do what the choreographer wanted to do. He didn't like being told what to step to and told what to move to. He felt like he was being trained like a trained monkey, he said at one point. So there was always tension. Not everyone was as malleable, but they all went through it, and they all in some way benefited, I think.
Motown was one of the first companies to do artist tours to help, get airplay for records and to expose the artists to wide audiences. You found out a lot about the tours, the first tours through the South, which coincided with a lot of civil rights demonstrations. What was life like on the road during those tours?
Well, it was very strange for them because, again, these are northern kids who are from northern communities. And for some of them, except for maybe the summer trips down south to visit the relatives, this is one of the first times they were below the Mason-Dixon line. And there were incidents. I mean, there were places where they could not eat. There were places where they people would say things. I mean, it was really not a very idyllic trip at all. In fact, during the trip down south, the road manager, Beans Bowles, was injured in a car accident, and one of the other drivers was killed. So it was not that first tour, the first Motown review tour, was really a very big learning experience. I think one thing that happened, they really learned they had to tighten up on artist development. Because there was a lot, I mean, one image is of one of the girls in the Marvelettes came on stage at the Apollo Theater chewing gum, you know, which is like, ugh, totally wrong. And that's the kind of thing that Motown really worked to avoid subsequently.
Because they wanted evening gowns and great hairdos.
But at the time, first they didn't have the money to afford it. One of the other little great anecdotes in there is from Maxine Powell, who was one of the tutors, more or less, for the girls, especially for the Supremes, about how she used to take, if she needed red shoes, and she'd paint shoes red, or if she had they needed a new lace thing, she would sew them herself. So at first they didn't have the money for all the glamorous things we think about. I mean, it really was a small-time operation, which was growing. It just grew so fast. And that was really so... So when we think of the sophisticated Motown act, we're thinking 64, 65, not 62, 63.
On the tour bus, you say that the musicians used to call the front of the bus Broadway and the back of the bus Harlem. Can you explain that?
Well, just that they were, and that's why I guess I focused the book more on the musicians and took their insights to heart, because they were more earthy. They had none of the airs that we associate sometimes with a Motown artist or the superstar mentality.
So the singers sat in the front of the bus and the musicians... in the back.
Basically, yeah. And there were, people in the middle. And the farther you closer you set to Barry, the more you were trying to be part of the major set, you know. So there was a real, I mean, the guys would be on the bus, and the musicians being older guys, too, you got to remember. I mean, they were smoking marijuana. They wanted to have a little taste, a little whiskey or something. And Barry, we don't want this. This is bad for our image. So the guys would stick their, like you do in like school kids do today, you would stick their cigarette out the window. And take a puff out the window and stuff like that. So it was a little, there was always tension between them. But what's interesting about that is that despite the fact that the musicians were a little more rambunctious, Barry had a great deal of respect for them because he knew their value. And in many ways, they felt they were treated better than the artists were.
Monetarily or?
Well, monetarily, I mean, for example, they went on the road. Motown International Talent Management was a management company. So the artists did not get paid when they did it. When they played the Uptown Theater in Philadelphia, the artists did not get that check or that $500 they were supposed to be paid. That money went back to Detroit, and the artists were giving a little bit of money to take care of whatever expenses, toiletries, whatever, and they could draw money off their account in Detroit. But that money went into a bank immediately, whereas the musicians got paid right there. And there's a couple of funny stories in there about the musicians feeling they were better off than the entertainers. And they wouldn't even stay in some of the hotels the entertainers would stay in, because Motown would book them in places at least that were, if not cheaper, not tacky, but at least cheaper, so they could conserve money. You got to understand, again, people have this image of Motown as being huge now and being very big. But we're talking about 62, 63. This is still not a big-time operation. It was growing. The potential was there. But it wasn't until 65, 66, that you could say that was an established company that really everyone knew was going to be successful.
Were there rules about the women singers not fraternizing with the musicians?
Absolutely. I mean, sometimes it didn't work out either. In fact, one of the funnier things I found out, both when I was working on the book and actually after the book came out, when people felt a little looser about telling me things, it was a lot more interaction among people sexually or romantically than I was led to believe at the time. I think people didn't want to get that part of it. And I really wasn't as interested in that as I'm sure someone else would be one day when there's a gossipy book done about Motown. I wasn't really concerned unless I felt it was really germane to the story, like the whole relationship between Diana and Barry, the relationship between David Ruffin and Tammy Terrell. These were things that I think were very important because it had an impact on their state of mind. Some of the other stuff was just basic, young people with money having a good time.
My guest is Nelson George, the author of A New History of Motown Records. It's called Where Did Our Love Go? During those early years of Motown, there was a big competition between Martha Reeves and the Vandellas and the Supremes about who was going to be the premier girl group of the company. How were they played off of each other?
I wouldn't say they were played off. I must say that Martha was the star first, but it became pretty clear that Barry and a lot of other people at the company felt that Diana had more potential because she was more girlish. She was, had more innocence. She was also very pliable. She was very willing to do what they wanted her to do in terms of how she wanted to act. Martha was had been around. She'd made records. She'd appeared on shows on her own before. She wasn't, you know, it was a difference between a young woman and a younger, a teenager. And they just felt that because Diana had that ability to take direction. It's like, you know, it was like more coachable, like a high school football coach. It's the difference between approaching a pro football player and a college football player. The college player will do more things on enthusiasm and energy, where the pro wants to get paid. And I think that Martha was also more outspoken about her relationship with if she felt she wasn't getting treated right, she would confront Barry with it. And not too many other people would do that.
Let's hear a little bit of Martha Reeves and the Vandellas, and this is Ready for Love. Right before we listened to that excerpt of Ready for Love about the competition between Martha Reeves and Diana Ross, and we were both thinking how much she sounds like Diana Ross on that record.
Well, this is when the Motown sound that they had developed for the Supremes was so prevalent. And it sounds to me, this almost sounds like a Supremes track, because Martha's, it's like a certain pocket. She's singing much more breathily. You notice that? Very breathy, which is that Diana Ross thing. And also, there's not as much room for her to be as wild. You know, she's a little rawer usually when she's sang. This is definitely, and also the way the vocal harmonies are arranged. Ready for Love, the way it kept coming in, sounds more like the way the Supremes were used.
The bass line that opens that up and that you hear through the record is so good. Would the bass player continue to get royalties from the records? Because the bass line is such an important part of that record.
No, Jameson is dead now, James Jameson. I mean, the book is dedicated to he and Benny Benjamin because I feel, for me, as a music person who loves music, and my joy is still listening to the interplay of that music, the drive of that music, the energy. Two stories about Jameson come to mind. One is that on Standing in the Shadows of Love, which is one of the great Motown records, he claims that the bass line for that song was influenced by Eastern music. He said a lot of Arabs had moved into his neighborhood in Detroit where he lived, and that he would listen to their music every now and then, and that the bass line on that, when he was working on that song, some of their melodies came to his mind, and that, in fact, that song, you would never think of it, but it's based on some degree on Islamic music. The other thing that comes to mind is that Get Ready, one of the great which the hook is, you know, that bass line. He said it was based on seeing this very amply, how should I describe this on radio, well-endowed woman walk down the street, and noticing the way her body swayed and saying, wow, that's amazing. And going in when he was working the record and her image came to his mind, he says the bass line sort of came from that. So, I mean, inspiration comes from very different places.
Let's get back to talking about Martha Reeves and Diana Ross and the competition between them. What were you think the reasons that it was Diana Ross and not Martha Reeves finally who gained supremacy in Motown and who Berry Gordy singled out? Was it something between Diana Ross and Berry Gordy that had anything to do with it?
Well, no, I think definitely, you know, there was something, some kind of relationship, a tight relationship between Berry and Diana. But Berry, you know, I don't think that was, he was too much of a businessman, from my point of view, to just let that be the only reason. I don't think that was the only reason. I think the other reason is this personality thing. For you to invest as much time and money as they did, and they invested a lot of time and money in Diana Ross, and that have someone who you won't do what you want her to do when you want her to do it is something. And Berry was obviously a guy who craved control and wanted saw control. Diana's a very, she's willing to do what was necessary. I really feel that was the essential thing. I also feel that she and Berry had were just personally very much the same kind of person. They're very driven, very ambitious. And they also had this idea about acceptance, about not just accepting what is given to us, but trying to get to become the mainstream of American life. I think they both wanted to be stars in their own way. Berry wanted the money. She wanted the stardom. And I mean, my feeling is that was it. I mean, there's a lot of Machiavellian things that people say, but I think it comes down to as simple as chemistry. I think the chemistry between those two was much superior to Berry's chemistry with Martha Reeves. I don't think he really had any.
There's also a lot of stories circulating about how Diana Ross became the lead singer of the Supremes when, you know, Flo Ballard and Mary Wilson would have liked to have that role, too. Did you learn anything new about that?
Well, I think the bottom line is the same, what I just said. She was, I mean, like, she would take the extra classes. And she also was very, she was also, how you put it, she knew how to play politics. She would go and stay late and come into Berry's office and talk to him and be sweet. And she was that with a lot of people. If you've seen her today in interviews, she has this way of almost melting in your mouth. And she had that when she was very young. She was not someone, I mean, when people say that Diana Ross has airs about her, one of my favorite quotes is a woman who's still in the music business today worked at Motown, and she said that, I always say in Diana Ross's defense, some people say that she's a real haughty and remote, but I say she was snotty back then when she lived in the projects. So the chemistry of what made Diana Ross was always there. It's more refined, but I think what we see is what we're getting. That's what she is.
When the Supremes were at their peak, they were competing with the Beatles for, you know, number one records.
They were beating the Beatles a lot. At the time, I believe, in the book I referred to, 64, I believe. Except for a few weeks, the only records that really were knocking out that whole stream of Beatlemania, which was going down, Please, Please Me, Help, and all that stuff, were Mary Wells and the Supremes were the only thing that knocked them out of the number one spot for most of that year.
What do you think is responsible for Motown's ability to cross over to black and white audiences?
The music. I think they came at a very special time. Well, music and social, but music primarily. I'm sorry. I think that what you're looking at when you look at Motown is a perfect fusion of pop, and I'm saying pop, Tin Pan Alley, white melodic ideas, black rhythm and aggressiveness in the music, and a real fusion of this in technology. I look at the spiritual forefathers of Motown's success is the Lieber and Stoller music, who did the Drifters and the Coasters, which was a very literate form of R&B. The lyrics are very carefully laid out to tell a story, often very funny stories. And then you have Phil Spector and the Wall of Sound. And his idea was to use black female voices against this very large, you know, Wagnerian type of sound, the Wall of Sound, as it was called. Motown sort of came of a mix of that, I think. I listen to Holland Doja Holland records, like Ready for Love. That's a very produced record. It's not like Stax records or James Brown records were very much played records. You know what I'm saying? Those records were like jams. The guys come in and play. Now, some Motown records are like that. But Holland Doja Holland in particular and the Motown sound were very particular. They would have guys play different things. They would mix different versions. they would take have a saxophone player play all the way through and then take his sound out and put it back in. They would maybe mix, they would have two guitar players come in, have another guitar player put another guitar line on top of that guitar line. So very produced, very processed music. While it still had that groove that the bass line would give you, it also had a very melodic sense. It had all these, what I call ear candy. You listen to that song, you hear strings way in the back, sort of. You hear congas a little bit very low. And these kind of things, you know, they're almost subliminal suggestion, like in advertising. You don't always think you're hearing them, but you are hearing them. And they just support the melodic ideas that are on top. So the hook is the thing that punches you in the mouth. The groove you dance to, and there's all these other elements that just tingle your eardrums. And I think of all the magical things that Motown did, it was this ability to bring these elements together consistently for so long is an amazing achievement.
It might be because Motown was such a close-knit group and there were so many regulars in it, both in, you know, the songwriters, the producers, the musicians, and the performers, that when people were ready to leave, that the leavings were often very, very bitter and acrimonious. For the performers and the musicians who you spoke to and the songwriters and producers who left, did you find out about a lot of displeasure that they felt about how they had been treated either artistically or financially?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a whole section of people. Like, there's a guy named Chuck Jackson who was Any Day Now was his biggest hit back in the early 60s. He was a big, belting black singer, had a very strong, deep, masculine voice. And he went to Motown thinking that they would do for him what they did for Levi Stubbs or the Four Tops, who had a similar kind of voice. Instead, he went there and his career went right down the tubes. He didn't have any hits. He barely had any releases. He just came in too late after the production line had sort of asserted itself. Billy Eckstein went there. People don't even know Billy Eckstein recorded for Motown. And he had a terrible experience there. Sammy Davis Jr. was there for a month. He had a deal with Motown for a month for his own label, and then he pulled out. It wasn't unusual. Gladys Knight is not a big fan of Motown at all to this day, and she will tell you that. That's why she wasn't on the Motown 25. So there was definitely bitterness. But also, I think there's a very important distinction to be made. A lot of people I'm referring to came in after 65. The early people have a different feeling for Motown than the later people. Holland Dozier Holland, when they left Motown, it was really bitter.
They were the songwriting team.
Holland Dozier Holland, Lamont Dozier, Eddie Holland, and Brian Holland. Their lawsuits, which I've seen, I went back to Detroit and went through all, waded through tons of depositions and royalty statements. And they were real sort of nasty to each other, real finger-pointing, and $25 million lawsuits.
What were they suing over?
Well, basically, it came right down to Holland Dozier Holland was trying to get away out of their contract. Because they signed a deal with two labels to have their own record labels. And Motown countersued to try and keep them, and Holland Dozier Holland sued, so back and forth. But now if you talk to them today, they just say basically it was a misunderstanding, you know. We just weren't communicating at that time. Because so much has happened. That ambivalence, so many of the people who were there early have ambivalence now. They're like, I love Barry, but Motown sometimes gave me a problem. But a lot of them go back. I mean, Junior Walker has had albums out recently. The Temptations went back. The Four Tops went back. Who knows? One day Donna Ross might go back. You never know. I mean, that's the kind of...
Well, there were a lot of groups that had trouble making it on their own afterwards, as much as they wanted their independence from that company. But that might have had to do with the times.
Well, Mary Wells' career was a disaster after she left. But the Isley Brothers had never had better success till they left. Gladys Knight never had better success till she left. David Ruffin's career was as a solo artist, was quite, you know, I was disastrous, but very, very disappointing after he left.
One of the really ugliest stories about someone leaving Motown was the way that Flo Ballard was forced out of the Supremes, and you found out a lot of information about that.
Yeah, and I'm going to say that my interpretation of this is from the Balladurian. I was more sympathetic to her because I really wanted to find out. And when I based my section on it was more what I got of her recollections, that she did a surprising amount of talking after she left, but people really didn't pay attention. I mean, I think that's what happened. People act like when she died, oh, she's just been shunted away into a corner. Florence did a lot of interviews and talked about what happened to her, but not too many people really paid attention at the time. And what her interpretation of it was that she'd been sick some. the tension between her and particularly Diana had been getting worse over time. And she had been ill a little bit. I think she drank a little bit. So she missed a few shows. Motown already had a lady from Philadelphia, Cindy Birdsong, prepared in the wings. In fact, several times she replaced Florence and people didn't know it. I didn't even really think there was it didn't hurt the performance, which is not good for Flo's position in the group at all. And when they got to Las Vegas for a big show, they were about to do Reflections. It was a new single. And this was also the time that Berry had planned to debut the new Diana Ross and the Supremes label. And while during that engagement, I think it was at the Sands or the Sahara, one night they told Flo, Flo did not go on, and Cindy Birdsong did. But what was the big news out of Las Vegas? The fact that Diana Ross, it was now Diana Ross and Supremes. People paid attention, but not, they were more focused in on this move than they were on the other one, which makes it look like it was to some degree orchestrated.
So instead of it being the Supremes, it was now Diana Ross and the Supremes,
right,
showing her supremacy in,
right,
in,
and
in
that
the
she was going to be a star on her, you know, it set up the fact she's going to be a solo star.
Do you know if Diana Ross had anything to do with the pushing out of Flo Ballard, or if that was Berry Gordy's idea?
I can't tell. I mean, that's one of those things you'd have to get. When someone interviewed Diana, I'd have to ask her that. And what she said at the time, and it was what I like history for, because people can change their story a million times in history. But at the time, what they said was that Flo was sick and she left of her own accord. She wasn't feeling well. And it even said at one point that they probably expected her maybe to rejoin the group, which, you know, was obviously a fabrication. And what happened to Flo later was, it's quite involved. She
Before we even get to what happened to her later, maybe you can describe the terms that she was forced to leave on, the offer that Berry Gordy made her when he told her she wasn't going to be a Supreme anymore.
Well, I don't want to give away all the numbers because that's in the book, but I'll say this. They had a meeting in Detroit. She went back to Detroit. She checked into a hospital. There was a meeting with a couple of vice presidents there, and it made a very small offer, and she did not have legal counsel at the time. She signed it. Some months later, she realized that this was not the right thing to do. She got legal counsel. There was a negotiation. And she finally did get more money. But also during that time, she signed a recording contract. Part of one of the stipulations in her contract, however, which would prove to haunt her, was that she could not use the fact she was the ex-Supreme in her advertising. And she could not talk about the contract, what happened, in her interviews. And she agreed to this, which was a big mistake. Because one of the things that happened, she was an ex-Supreme that a lot of people didn't even know she was an ex-Supreme. And her record came out. She tried to get publicity. She couldn't use that because of her contract and her publicity campaigns. These kind of things, moves she made afterwards, came back to haunt her. Then later on, after the second contract had been negotiated, which still had some of these same stipulations, she sued again, saying that this contract was invalid, that I really shouldn't have signed this, it's too late. The court held in Detroit that while there are some things about this contract which are not, we don't think are necessarily right, you did sign it, you did have legal counsel, and it is binding.
Do you see that whole incident with the Supremes and with the pushing out of Flo Ballard as being a turning point in Motown's history? And a symptom of a direction that they were heading into, and a kind of breaking apart of the family.
Well, I guess it could be used that way. I just see that as a special story of its own within the context of a lot of other stories. I think that was it was symptomatic of an overall slow erosion of that family thing. And to this day, you know, people who still like Berry. And it's interesting, I got to say this over and over again. I if I had a title for the book, actually, I would say ambivalence, almost, as much as Will I Love Go. Because every one of them still says that they really have some measure of respect for Berry, or even if they haven't talked to him in 15 years, they still feel there are certain things that were done there that weren't right.
Such as
the Flo Ballard thing. And it bothers them. You know, during that period, too, Motown was marked by a lot of tragedy. You know, Paul Williams had to leave the Temptations because he was having real problems with alcohol and with his own mental state. The pressure of success got to him, and eventually, in a very bizarre incident, he committed suicide in a car 3 or 4 blocks from Motown Studios. He shot himself in the head. Tammy Terrell collapsed on stage while performing with Marvin Gaye and eventually died, another Philadelphia native, of brain tumors. So, I mean, I look at the book and I look at the whole history. 1967 was epitome. The Supremes had all these number one records. They played the Houston Astrodome, the eighth wonder of the world. They played Carnegie Hall. There was Supremes Bread out. Remember Supremes Bread? I'm sure you don't. There was a bread called Supremes Bread.
I don't remember.
There was all kinds of, Motown had done it. They were it. They were American success for Black American. And when you reach that level of success, there is always that sign of decay. And I think that we can see a decay and a change up until they moved to L.A.
Why did they move to L.A.?
Well, I believe, people, it's popular not to believe their reasoning for going. But I actually do believe that Barry and them wanted to get out of Detroit. I mean, you've got to think in context. This is 1968. Detroit was racked with racial violence. We'd had the worst race riot in the history of this nation, perhaps in Detroit. The facilities they had were old. Even when they moved into a new place, it was not nearly enough room for what they had in mind. And Barry was already, by 67, really 68, was spending most of his time in L.A. or New York or in Vegas, where he was trying to get his acts ensconced in Las Vegas scene, trying to get more and more TV specials, as we saw. So for him, he felt that this was a movie he had to make. I don't necessarily agree with the thought process behind it. I think that he could have left much more of a presence in Detroit than he did and benefited both ways, coming and going. But that was his decision. And I think that, so I guess that's basically his reasoning. I would agree that that was his reason. He did want to get into movies. It's quite clear that that's what he tried to do. And he has had up and down success doing so.
But you think it really changed the record company and changed the sound, too, when they moved?
Well, I mean, just physically, you had different speakers. You had different equipment. The records are not going to sound the same because you're in a different studio. That's number one. But also, the music industry had changed. The floodgates that Norman Whitfield had opened, let's say, with Psychedelic Shack and Cloud Nine. Now you had Sly Stone. You had Jimi Hendrix out here. You had the beginnings. Curtis Mayfield was getting to a more complicated sound. Isaac Hayes had this weird approach where he was making these long, long songs. Black music was changing profoundly. And Motown had instigated this change, but the Motown wasn't changing fast enough to go with it. Also, as a result of all the money that Stax and Atlantic and Motown had generated through black music crossing over to white buyers, the major record companies, your CBS's, your Warner Brothers, RCA, said, look, we've got to make a commitment to getting a piece of this market, just like any company. Let's make some market acquisitions. And some of those market acquisitions were Motown people. Ashford and Simpson, who was the last of the fantastic songwriting team, signed a deal with RCA Records. Holland Doja Holland had two distribution deals. They had a label. One was called Hot Wax, and one was called Invictus. They had two labels of their own, distributed by two different major companies. We had Harvey Fuqua, a guy I mentioned earlier, had a deal with RCA. Talent drain. And also part of this geographic question is, when you're in L.A., it's a lot harder to keep your artist and your creative people secret than it is in Detroit, Michigan.
You're not going to get this homegrown sense that these are all this is the best talent from the neighborhood or from the city. It's just different in Los Angeles.
How are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Bel Air? I mean, these record companies said to them, look, we can give you the same money we're giving so X amount of people to do these records. And at that point, Motown decided they didn't want to compete. I think the only person you can say of that early group that they really worked hard to keep was Stevie Wonder. And I guess in many ways he was the most valuable one.
My guest is music writer Nelson George, and we're discussing the history of Motown Records, which is the subject of his new book, Where Did Our Love Go? I guess it was in 1984 that there was a TV broadcast of the Motown 25th anniversary special in which we got to see a lot of the older acts and a lot of the newer acts performing together. And, Michael Jackson did some Jackson 5 stuff and then did Billie Jean. What did that show epitomize to you about where Motown had been and where it was going?
Well, it was very clear that was a nostalgia show. Except for Michael Jackson, the high points were moments of the past. I think DeBarge was very good. I always liked DeBarge. But that other group they had with them, High Energy, that girl group, they're no longer there. The Commodores, that was Commodores' Outline of Richie. The Commodores are no longer at Motown. They've left. All the moments that we think about from that show when the Supremes came on, the battle between the Four Tops and the Temptations. The lead singer, I mean, the Temptations, if you looked at them, very few, there's only a couple of guys who are original guys. Dennis Edwards, who was the lead singer for the Temps and was so great on that show, now is a solo artist on his own. He's on Motown, but the Temptations have had a new lead singer, yet another one. So I think that it really showed that their glory years were in the past. And I think that they also showed, for me, a rather sad lack of history. And, you know, even though it was a show about the past, ironically, they did not mention once during the show any of the musicians I've talked about. The producers who I've mentioned, Smokey, obviously because he was a former performer, was there. I don't believe Holland Doja Holland's name was mentioned but maybe once, and they were in it on screen for maybe a minute. I don't believe Norman Whitfield's name was mentioned at all. I don't believe Florence Ballard's name was mentioned at all. I think we needed, that sort of disturbed me. That was one of the inspirations, again, for this particular book. I don't think that I tried to write expose, per se. That's not my real style as a journalist. I feel I'm more of an historian. But I feel that the history has not been told straight. And this is as close as I think we're going to come at this point in time to a complete history of Motown. I do believe, and I hope it's going to happen, I would love Barry Gordy to write his own book. I would love to see what his interpretation of his life is from his point of view. Also, Mary Wilson, if I can put a plug in for my publisher, has Mary Wilson under contract to do her own book. Unfortunately, Mary's on, the book has not gone as well as it could have at this point. But hopefully that'll be out, and that'll be another interpretation. What we need now, this is such an important part of our culture as Americans. I think we need to hear some other voices. And I hope that my book sparks people, even if they don't like it, to bring their side of the story out.
I want to ask you a couple of quick questions before we run out of time. Motown Records have been used in, like, The Big Chill, a very big part of the movie. I don't know if you've
Oh, sure,
seen it or
yeah.
Not.
The opening of that was one of the best music videos I've ever seen.
And I forget which one, but there's at least one commercial.
Mercury.
That, yeah.
Mercury Motor
which is,
Cars.
Which is the song that they're using?
They're using a number.
Yeah.
They're using Reach Out.
Right.
They're using, I think, Nowhere to Run, maybe. One of the, there's a Arthur yeah. Vandella song being used.
Huh.
They also use Tammy Terrell and Marvin Gaye tunes.
Right. What do you think about that? Do you feel like music you really love is being stolen for commercial purposes? I mean, it was always very commercial music, but how do you really feel seeing it used to sell automobiles and, you know, and movie soundtracks?
Unfortunately, the greatest art of the American society is capitalism. We sell people things. That's how we make money. We make them give us their money. Like I'm here with my book trying to give you to buy my book. Motown was doing the same thing. I phase out. I don't look at TV anyway. I'm one of those minority Americans. So I try and stay away from that. Myself, it's very in character with Motown. It's in terms of what the company's history is, I'm not surprised. I'm surprised it took them this long to do it.
You're at Billboard, you're the black music editor there, and it's an interesting title because I mean there's rock music and then there's black music, which is, you know, defined. And I wonder how you feel about that category of black music and also how, and I've left you about I think 2 minutes to respond to this, but also how segregated now does music feel to you in America?
Well, actually, we're in a good period. There's more interaction now than there ever has been. I mean, not ever has been. I don't know if ever, but there's more interaction now, certainly since the 70s was a bad decade for interaction. Fragmentation, demographic breakdowns led to a fragmentation of listening patterns. Radio stations began programming according to X amount, 18 to 25 demographical breakdown of people who make over $30,000 a year, things like that. Now with Madonna, who people may not like, but Madonna is basically a white artist who does R&B or dance music. She's almost like the Donna Summer of the 80s. I look at her that way. So we've seen a lot of interaction from a lot of white groups, and you see much more easily acceptance of Prince has led us to let black music use more rock rhythms, use more rock guitar. Beat It was very important in that. So there is a lot more interaction, I would say, than there has been in a while. But I also say I was one of the people who came up with the idea of the black music section. It was called the soul section before that. And when I joined Billboard as a black music editor in 1982, there was no way this was soul music. That soul music was a particular moment in history, a particular artistic expression. No way that I could say to Rick James and Prince and also Stephanie Mills were doing quote unquote soul music, or George Clinton in Parliament. No way. So we had to come up with a better way of dealing. We're going to call it the funk section. That would have been my title, but that was a little too esoteric. So we had to come up with black music as a generic term. Now, black music could also mean gospel, could also mean jazz. But I feel comfortable with black music as a term. I mean, I use R&B a lot, too. But I think, again, that's almost an historic term more than it is a contemporary term. So I feel that actually we're a little luckier now. I think as black, using the term black music, we're not saying that it has to sound a certain way. When you say this was soul stuff, it sort of had to sound gospel-y.
Do you think that there's any equivalent now in black music of Motown, like one plays, one company or whatever?
Well,
that's
people who are 60s people are going to hate me for saying that. But there's two places. One is Prince and his whole operation. He has his groups, and he has his own big factory up in, he's got a big old building in Minneapolis where he has all his acts. That's one. And two is a friend of mine named Russell Simmons who has rap acts. He has a label called Def Jam Records. He manages Curtis Blow, Run DMC, Houdini. And he's very much a street, he's a young guy, just like Barry. He has a whole little roster of young street guys. So while this is not, for any 60s person, this is not going to ring any wonderful bells, I don't think. It just goes to show you that music progresses on. But the forms of music may change, but the ideas of how to structure and market them haven't moved that far.
Nelson George, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. My guest has been Nelson George, and he's black music editor of Billboard magazine. We've been talking about the history of Motown Records, which is the subject of his new book, Where Did Our Love Go?, which is also the title of a very popular Supreme song. And Where Did Our Love Go? Has just been published on the St. Martin's Press. The author's name again, Nelson George. It's 5:00. All Things Considered is coming up in just 2 minutes from National Public Radio. I'll tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air after we check in with Shadow Traffic.
Thank you and good afternoon. In Thornbury, Delaware County, there's an accident on Cheney Woods Road right near the railroad crossing. A car and train were involved in that around 3:30. Pennsylvania Turnpike's tied up eastbound between the Willow Grove Interchange and exit 28 because of a couple of accidents. Route 611 to Street Road or Route 63 might be good alternates for you. Schuylkill Expressway construction delays about 15 minutes on the distance between the Roosevelt Boulevard and Belmont Avenue. 95 northbound, slow on the right side between Academy and Woodhaven Road. I'm Bob Murphy, reporting shadow traffic on WHYY 91 FM.
The shadow traffic report was funded by AD&P Realtors. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 3:00, I'll speak with Jane Moss, author of Adventures of an Advertising Woman. Christiane Vaillancourt will report on the arts at 3:45. And at 4:00, we'll hear from actress Janet Leigh, best known for her role in Psycho. Friday afternoon at 3:00, we're going to rebroadcast an interview with Trevor Farrell. If you saw the State of the Union address last night, you'll know that he was singled out by the president for his work with the homeless in Philadelphia. At 4:00, we'll talk about television with Philadelphia Inquirer television critic David Bianculli and television critic for the Philadelphia Daily News, David Friedman. This Sunday at 6:00 on the Best of Fresh Air, my guest will be cellist Yo-Yo Ma, so I hope you can be listening. Well, that about does it for today's show. The engineers for today's show were Audrey Voblaitis and Ron Barron. Amy Salad is the associate producer, Danny Miller, co-producer of the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a very good evening. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley.
Local transmission of All Things Considered Today is made possible in part by a grant from Bartash Publications, who specialize in the printing of newspapers, circulars, television books, and catalogs.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. This is Noah Adams.
And I'm Susan Stamberg with All Things Considered.